Bitte.
It's okay. Firstly, I just want to say thank you for the chance to preach this morning. It really is a joy and a privilege, and I just pray that in some way this will be a blessing to you, as you've all blessed me over the past 3 years now. As Dan said, this is either the last or second last preach in 2 Corinthians for now. I just want to get straight into this passage. Can I just pray before we start? Heavenly Father, Lord Almighty, you are God, infinite, eternal, unchanging, magnificent beyond anything we can fully understand or imagine. And we are just humans, tiny creatures on this vast planet called Earth. But you are our God. As we'll see, in Christ, we know you. It's real, it's personal, and it's the best thing in the world. And God, we just pray that you would speak to us today. I just pray that you'd speak through me, that you'd speak through your word, and you'd make your word alive to us, that we'd know that you're dealing with us as a whole, as a church, as a body, and you're dealing with us as individuals. You know us personally. Each unique person here is known to you, matters to you, and always has, and always will. God, we just pray that you would that you chose Christ. For Jesus' sake, amen. You remember this is Paul's second letter to the Corinthians. Corinth was and is a town 50 miles west of Athens. It was a city-state at the time this was written, really important, big city. Nowadays, it's quite a small place, just twice the size of East Finchley. But at that time, it was very large, very prosperous, like London, like New York. And I'm not going to sort of restate the whole story so far too much. We know that there's issues in the church, that they've fallen out with the Apostle Paul, that Paul's having to write to them to explain, to defend his ministry. And we've seen that over and over. And that's still the context. If you look at verse 11 to 13, as Alice read, "We've spoken freely to you, Corinthians, and opened wide our hearts to you. We are not withholding our affection from you, but you're withholding yours from us. As a fair exchange, I speak as to my children, open wide your hearts also." And if you go forwards to chapter 7, verse 2, Paul almost repeats himself. "Make room for us in your hearts." It's almost the same thing, isn't it? "Make room for us in your hearts." And then he goes on to defend his ministry. "We've wronged no one. We've corrupted no one. We've exploited no one. I don't say this to condemn you. I've said before that you have such a place in our hearts that we would live or die with you. I have great confidence in you. I take great pride in you. I'm greatly encouraged. In all our troubles, my joy knows no bounds." So that's the context. At one end, you've got "open wide your hearts" also. at the other end, make room for us in your hearts. And I'm not going to really talk too much about those verses because Dan talked about them last week. And this passage, the second half of chapter 6, is really continuing the first half of chapter 6. What I'd like to focus on today is verses 14 to chapter 7, verse 1. This is something different. We haven't really had this so far in this letter, particularly that command at the start of verse 14. Do not be yoked together with unbelievers. This isn't really ground that Paul has covered so far. And as I just said, it's a command. It's something we're meant to do or not do. And if you look further down to verse 17, there's another command along the same lines. Therefore, come out from them and be separate, says the Lord. Touch no unclean thing. And lastly, go further down to chapter 7, verse 1. Since we have these promises, dear friends, let us purify ourselves from everything that contaminates body and spirit, perfecting holiness out of reverence for God. So you've got three commands there, and they're all similar. They're all related. They're all about holiness and about being set apart, devoted, holy to God, to Jesus, rather than following what everyone else does, whether or not it's got anything to do with Jesus. As I said, there's those three commands, but you'll notice they're all really short. Do not be yoked together with unbelievers. Stop. Therefore, come out from them and be separate. Touch no unclean thing. Stop. Let us purify ourselves from everything that contaminates body and spirit, perfecting holiness out of reverence for God. Stop. So what's everything in between? If that's what we're meant to do, why does Paul take seven verses to do it, to say that? I'd suggest that the answer is motivation. We will look at precisely what those commands mean. Obviously, we need to do that. But for the Corinthians, and maybe for us, the challenge might not be so much knowing what to do as whether we're motivated, whether we're willing to do that. Are we willing to not be yoked together with unbelievers, whatever that means? Are we willing to come out from them and be separate, whatever that means? We'll look at it soon. Are we willing to purify ourselves as we were singing, as we were praying with the song earlier? So this morning I'd like to tackle this passage in three steps. The first step is to look at the promises in this chapter. God's given these amazing promises. I will live with them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. That's verse 16. And then again, end of verse 17, into verse 18. I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you will be my sons and daughters. So we've got these amazing promises. That's where I'd like to start. What are they? What are they about? Secondly, we'll look at sort of the logic of that. How do we get from the promises to we should or shouldn't be doing this? Which is mostly verse 15. And then lastly, we'll come back to the commands and what they mean, how they apply to us today. If If you've got a church Bible there, it'd be really great if you could turn to it, because we're going to have to turn to quite a few different passages here. I'll give page numbers, but if you could get a church Bible, that would be great. The reason is, did you see that tiny letter C at the end of verse 16? It's like really small. It's a footnote. If you look down to the bottom of the page, it's a C16, verse 16. Then it's got some references from the Old Testament. Leviticus chapter 26, verse 12. Jeremiah 32, 38. Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 27. What's that about? Paul's quoting from the Old Testament. He's repeating things that have been written centuries before, but were relevant for the Corinthians in AD 51 or so, and relevant for us in 2017. So, can we turn back to Leviticus? Third book of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. It's chapter 26, verse 12. On page 130. Page 130. The context is the people of Israel under Moses have left Egypt. And they're going to the Promised Land. And God is giving the law. He's saying, do this and you'll be my people. This is how I want you to live. This is who you're going to be. I've chosen you, Abraham's children, Abraham's people. This is what I want you to do. This is how you'll be special. This is how you'll be blessed. Verse 11. I will put my dwelling place among you, and I will not abhor you. This is God speaking, I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt so that you would no longer be slaves to the Egyptians. I broke the bars of your yoke and enabled you to walk with heads held high. Just imagine you in an Israelite. Put yourself in their shoes or sandals. You've been a slave in Egypt. Your parents were slaves, your grandparents were slaves, your great-grandparents. 400 years. Now you've left Egypt. You've been set free. And why have you been set free? God has set them free. Yes, for their benefit, but also his glory. They were to be his people. It would show just who he was, just how wonderful the Lord is. He could do that. He could take 2 million or so people out of a country. No one had ever done that. No God had ever done that. Let's go forward to Jeremiah. Jeremiah 32, chapter 36. It's on page 795. Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 36. You are saying about this city, that's Jerusalem, the Babylonian army is outside, so it's not a good situation. You are saying about this city, by the sword, famine, and plague, it will be handed over to the king of Babylon. But this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I will surely gather them from all the lands where I banished them in my furious anger and great wrath. I will bring them back to this place and let them live in safety. They will be my people, and I will be their God. So it's that same promise that Paul quotes. They will be my people, and I will be their God. This is before they even go into exile. That's the wonderful thing. The Babylonian army is about to conquer them, take all the Jews to Babylon. They're going to be there for 70 years, then they'll come back. And God's already promising, this is what I'm going to do for you after you come back. Like, God knows exactly what he's doing. He is totally in control. Let's go back one chapter, Jeremiah 31, verse 31. Page 793. I'm going to read verses 31 to 33. And the reason is there's something here that we've already looked at. In chapter 3 of 2 Corinthians, do you remember it talked about a new covenant? This new covenant, something new that God is going to do, that we experience now. So by way of reminder, just follow that. The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt. So that's what we were talking about earlier, what we just looked at in Leviticus. This old covenant that God made with their ancestors, their forefathers, took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt. Because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. That's why they went into exile. That's why they had to go to Babylon. Because time and time again, they wouldn't live as God told them to live. They could have, but they wouldn't. And eventually, for their sake, to get their attention, to make them wake up and turn back to him for their benefit, because the greatest blessing any of us can have is to know God. To make them wake up and come back to him, God sends them into exile. For breaking his covenant, this promise, this relationship they had. But that's not the end of the story. Like I just said, he's doing it for their benefit. It's to bring them back. It's to get them to wake up and enjoy that relationship with God again. Verse 33. This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. This is new. This wasn't in Leviticus. This wasn't given through Moses. This writing, middle verse 33, I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. That wasn't there. This is something new, something better, something different. And because of that, I will be their God takes on new meaning, deeper meaning. I will be their God, and they will be my people. They were his people. but they weren't living like it. An illustration. Imagine a married couple, and one person runs away. They're unfaithful, they leave. And it's not they've ceased to be married, but the person who's left is not living like they're still with their partner. And imagine the person who's been left goes to them and says, come back, be my wife, be my husband. Technically, they hadn't stopped being, but they weren't living like it. Do you see? That's kind of what's... Am I making sense? Yeah? That's kind of what's going on here. It says there, end of verse 32, I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. But the wife, in this case, Israel, the people of Israel, the Jews, hadn't been faithful to God. We'll see the application to us in a minute. Let's go back to 2 Corinthians. I hope that background will be helpful. We'll come together. I know we're dipping in and out very quickly. If you look at verse 16... starts with a question. It's really continuing from verse 15. What agreement is there between the temple of God and idols? We'll come back to that in a moment. For we are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will live with them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. Got a question. Is this future, as in God promises this and it's going to happen for us? We're talking about us now, not the Jews of ancient Israel. Us here today, 21st century. Is this promise something God promises to us way in the future? Or is it something that's true now, in the present? Or, I've kind of already ruled it out, but was it something that happened long ago when Paul quotes it here, in this context? Anyone brave enough to say? No? Okay. Look at verse 16 again. For we are the temple of the living God. We are. It's the second. It's true now. This isn't something we have to wait till heaven to get. This is right here, right now. In East Finchley, in 2017, or indeed anywhere in the world. For those who belong to Jesus, we are the temple of the living God. What does that mean? How many, can I have a show of hands? How many people have ever been in a temple? Any kind of temple? A bit higher? One, two. Okay. So about maybe a quarter of us, third of us. A temple is, it's a place to meet God, or our God, so-called. It's, people go there in order to meet God. That's the idea. It's a special place to meet God. We don't believe that you have to go to a church building to meet God. They're very convenient. We're very grateful for this building. and for everyone who maintains it. But it's not like you have to be here to meet God, and you can't face him at home or on the bus or in the office or, you know. The Jews had a temple. First they had a tabernacle, a tent, that was the time of Leviticus. Then they had a temple, that's the time the prophet Jeremiah and so on. And that's where God lived among them. That's how he lived among them, walked among them. But they couldn't go into the temple unless they were priests. And even the priest, there was only one priest, the high priest, was allowed to go into the innermost part of the temple where the glory of God was, with God's presence. So it was wonderful, but incomplete. That was the old covenant, wonderful, but incomplete. But we're under the new covenant. Paul's talked about that all in verse chapter 3. Sorry, wrong chapter. Yeah, chapter 3, verse 6. He has made us competent as ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. I know I'm jumping from thing to thing. What I'm hoping we'll see is that these concepts, these ideas, the new covenant, the temple, God being our God, they're actually all joined together. I know I'm not being terribly logical, but they do all go together. And I hope this will kind of tie it together. We are the temple of the living God. That means that God lives in us. Doesn't matter where you are, who you're with, whether you're at work, whether you're swimming, whether you're playing with your children, wherever you are, God is there. Isn't that an incredible thought? God is there and in us by his Spirit. And there's a particular... he is particularly present when we meet together as believers. Remember, Jesus says, where two or three gather in my name, there I am among them. So this morning, Jesus is here in this building. We can't see him because he's not, you know, walking the earth now. But his Spirit is here. He's present. He's here and right here, which is incredible. And that's true for anywhere where two or three Christians are gathered together. That's how God lives among us and walks among us. I think we must move on. Can we just go to verse 15 very quickly? And then we'll get to those commands. Very briefly. Can I have another show of hands? Who likes logic? Who would say they're a logical thinker? They're, you know, quite... I go from this to that. You know, when you make decisions, you think it through. It's not so much an emotional decision, it's... You know, I've weighed this up. Logical thinkers. Okay. That's what I thought. It's 50-50. I'm presuming that everyone who didn't put their hand up is wouldn't be a logical thinker. You'd be more intuition, emotion. Paul was a logical thinker. And you see it really clearly here. And by the way, it's not a good or a bad thing. You can be a logical thinker or different. They're both good. Paul was a logical thinker. And you see that really clearly here. Look at verse 14. See that tiny word for, F-O-R, not the number. F-O-R, for. What do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness? What harmony is there between Christ and Belial? What does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? What agreement is there between the temple of gods and idols? That word again, for. Logical word. For we are the temple of the living God. He's reasoning. It's like the Corinthians are there, sort of in his mind, and he's imagining what they would say. Paul says to them, don't be yoked together with unbelievers. The Corinthians go, why not? Paul goes, for what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? What fellowship can light have with darkness? What harmony is there between Christ and Belial? What does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? What agreement is there between the temple of God and idols? Corinthians go, see what he's saying. Believer, unbeliever, But what about the temple? What's that got to do with anything? And Paul goes, we are the temple of the living God. It's back and forth. I hope that helps. It's back and forth argument. And it comes down to those promises. We have those promises. They're true now. We are the temple of the living God. And that changes things. How does it change things? Final point. We'll come to the... I keep calling them commands. They are commands. But I have to add that God's commands aren't burdensome. This is not... It's like, do this, or else. God isn't like that. It's do this because this is going to make you happy. More happy than anything else in the long run. Because this is how you're going to know me. Start at verse 14. Don't be yoked together with unbelievers. Yoked is... The picture is two oxen plowing, and they have a wooden yoke holding them so that they both go in the same direction, and they don't plow sort of squint. They actually plow the way they're meant to. Did you notice in the Leviticus reading, God said, I broke the yoke from your neck. They were yoked in Egypt. And Paul doesn't want us to go back to that. Obviously, we've come from Egypt, but we've come out of a spiritual Egypt. We've left behind one life and move to a new one. Kingdom of darkness, kingdom of light. Not because we're special, but because God's forgiven us. He's changed us and is changing us. But the Corinthians had forgotten that. And they were going to get yoked again. I'm over time and really should stop. So let me just try to apply this. How can we get yoked with unbelievers? Well, the context. We've been talking about false teachers. That's who Paul's defending his ministry against. So we get yoked if we don't, I can put this. This is going to stop us getting yoked. We need to stick to the Bible. Doesn't matter how impressive or clever or rich someone, a Christian teacher is. If they're not talking from this, they could be saying anything. It's not God's message they're bringing, it's their own. Do you not be yoked together with unbelievers? And we're also yoked if we have the same values as everyone else. If everyone else is gossiping in our office and we join it. If everyone else is getting plastered and we do as well. If everyone else is racist and we are, that's not being the temple of the living God. I want to encourage you this morning. I really want to encourage you that God is at work through us every moment of every day, so much more than we realize. We are the temple of the living God. He is in us. And we're going to look back from heaven and be astonished at how much he used us when we didn't even realize it. Final thing. Could you turn to Revelation 21, please? It's on page 1249. Read from verse 2. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people." Same phrase. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. It's that promise again. But there is one future element here. I said this is all present with the Corinthians. And that's true. We are the temple of the living God. But there is a way in which it's not fulfilled yet and will only be fulfilled in glory. And that is that we will actually see Jesus. He's here by his spirit, but we can't see him. He doesn't walk the earth. And the world is not the way it should be. That's going to change. Totally. That's our hope. Verse 4. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the old order of things has passed away. is just have a moment to pray, just to talk to God, ask him what he wants us to take from his words this morning. Then I think it's communion.